Previously on Forever Chemicals.
We explored the discovery of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, also known as PFAS, and how they were developed to be used in products like nonstick cookware, waterproof and stain-resistant textiles, and firefighting foams.
If I start with what is PFAS? PFAS is a very big group of fluororganic chemicals and polymers. They have what are called extraordinary properties.
PFAS are industrial chemicals, and the carbon-fluorine bond is perhaps the strongest in the periodic table. It takes the energy of lightning to break it.
PFAS are known as forever chemicals.
The chemical industry knew that PFAS could be harmful.
So it's used in places that folks don't think. It's in every pizza box that you've gotten a pizza in. It's in your coffee cup at your favorite coffee joint around the corner. It's in cosmetics. You know, it's everywhere.
PFAS chemicals are wreaking havoc on our health and environment.
It's a really serious issue.
So there's health impacts and there are environmental impacts.
So many of them have been found to last essentially on geologic time.
Difficult to remove, difficult to filter, and then once removed and filtered, difficult to dispose of. They have been found to bioaccumulate in people and animals and have been found in almost every living creature on Earth.
We need to eliminate our apparent appetite for using PFAS.
The environmental impacts are pretty potent. Many of us refer to these as forever chemicals.
Some of the contamination we're worried about today actually started, you know, maybe 50 years ago. And it's, of course, much harder to remove the PFAS from the environment if this is like contamination of soil or this is a waste deposit site, because PFAS has over the years penetrated and moved downwards with rainwater, whatever it is, and perhaps reached the groundwater. And then from there, it has spread out, has reached various waterways like rivers or lakes. And so the contamination has moved, it has disseminated, and therefore created a much bigger problem.
If this is your first time listening, I recommend going back and tuning in to the first episode to get a full scope and background on what PFAS are and how they were created. As a recap, in episode one, Arlene Bloom, the founder of the Green Science Policy Institute, defined PFAS for us.
PFAS are industrial chemicals that consist of a chain of carbon surrounded by fluorine atoms. And the carbon-fluorine bond is perhaps the strongest in the periodic table. It takes the energy of lightning to break it. And PFAS are forever. Once you have a PFAS, it never breaks down in the environment. And sadly enough, all the ones that have been well studied have been found to be toxic in one of a variety of ways. So a chemical that's toxic and never breaks down is a big worry.
A lot has changed since PFAS was first discovered in the late 1930s. And over time, as more uses for PFAS emerged, there still seemed to be a veil pulled over the risks involved in using them.
When I looked at the history about the hazards, known incidents, already in 1954, toxicologists at DuPont knew they were toxic. In 1961, 3M toxicologists concluded that PFAS could bind to proteins. So they have known for 60 years that these chemicals are toxic and they should be very handled with care. Somehow, this knowledge was diminished somehow. So awareness, if you mean public awareness, it may be the last 20 years, but it has been a well-known secret for the industry for 60 years.
What's shocking about chemical companies like 3M and DuPont is that they not only hid their scientific findings of the PFAS health hazards from the public, but they hid them from the scientific community as well.
I'm Philippe Grandchamp. I'm a professor of environmental medicine at the University of Southern Denmark, and I'm also a research professor at the University of Rhode Island. I've been a full professor for 40 years. And I've been doing research on PFAS and their effects on human health for about 15 years. I started kind of late because industry kept their information secrets until about year 2000 or about that. And so I was not informed about this. Information was not shared with the public until the US EPA released these secret documents that they had gotten hold of through legal procedures. And then some animal studies were published, and it was discovered that, for example, the immune system in rodents was damaged and harmed by PFASs. And I happened to see that. I don't know all of the information that was hidden. That is, it wasn't published. It wasn't shared with the authorities like it should have been, according to American law. But I do know that early studies on rodents were done in the 1960s and 1970s. This is like 50 years ago. And so these studies found damage to the liver, and some of them showed particular types of cancer. And in 1978, a study was done in monkeys that showed that the PFAS exposure harmed the immune system. 1978. And there was no follow-up of this. So, because, I mean, if I had seen this, I would say, we need to understand what the consequences are. Apparently, it wasn't done. And when a medical doctor carried out studies of workers, production workers with high exposures, he found damage to their white blood cells. And he then raised the question, this was in 1992, 1993, something like that. He raised the question, but the study was done on monkeys in 1978. Why hasn't there been any follow-up? And so he wrote his PhD thesis on this, and one can obtain a copy from the university, but it wasn't published, those findings that he had. And so it looked like the company was more concerned about protecting their interests rather than releasing the truth.
Chemical companies like 3M and DuPont or Chemours got away with all of this for so long, despite the knowledge that PFAS chemicals, particularly the types they use widely in their manufacturing, were harmful. Hiding these facts was seen as more beneficial than sharing them. According to an article in The Intercept, The Teflon Toxin, DuPont and the Chemistry of Deception by Sharon Lerner, in 1978, DuPont's own medical director, Bruce Carah, stated that DuPont, quote, should be candid and lay all the facts on the table. This is the only responsible and ethical way to go, unquote. Despite this insider recommendation, DuPont and 3M continued to disclose only some of the facts that specifically went in their favor. In the same year, DuPont shared a 3M study of C8, a type of PFAS, accumulating in workers' blood, and began testing their own workers only to find increased rates of endocrine disorders and abnormal liver function due to the high levels of exposure. Yet, DuPont chose not to disclose these findings to regulators like the EPA. While they concealed the results of their studies for decades, the health and environmental impacts of PFAS finally came to light because of a farmer in West Virginia. With the help of lawyer Robert Bellot, a local farmer sued DuPont in 1998 due to the loss of cattle they claimed died due to PFOA pollution. PFOA is one type of PFAS that is well studied and known to cause health complications.
We have collaborated with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and the agency has concluded that two of the PFASs, those that are best known, actually the ones that have decreased over time, they are carcinogenic. They cause cancer. And therefore, the proper limit for these compounds is zero.
Through that lawsuit, internal DuPont documents were leaked showing that DuPont was aware of the dangers PFOA posed as early as 1961, and they knew by 1984 that these chemicals were present in the local water supply and being emitted in dust from factory chimneys. They did not disclose this to workers or the surrounding public. It is believed that the DuPont plant dumped and emitted over 1.7 million pounds of PFOA into the Parkersburg, West Virginia community between the years of 1951 and 2003.
There were a number of larger cases that came about, one which was depicted in a recent movie called Dark Waters, starring Mark Ruffalo, involving a production facility, a manufacturing facility in West Virginia that was producing PFAS chemicals and the contamination arising around that manufacturing facility. Cases like that brought PFAS into sort of the public consciousness.
From the 1998 lawsuit until the present day, a number of other lawsuits have been filed against chemical companies due to pollution and health impacts on surrounding communities. Outside of the well-known 1998 DuPont case in West Virginia, 3M was also subject to a high-profile lawsuit in 2010 that revealed even more scientific cover-ups.
When I worked with the state of Minnesota, I was given access to documents, internal documents that were in the public arena, but that particularly related to health aspects of PFAS exposure. And one of the documents was a draft report that examined whether PFAS exposure in production workers could interfere with the lipid metabolism, particularly cholesterol, so that they might develop elevated cholesterol in blood as a result of the exposure. And that might, of course, result in a greater risk of cardiovascular disease. And this study was published in a scientific journal that often publishes industry studies. And it looked like there wasn't any problem. And this study has been cited numerous times by governmental institutions and scientists. And when I compare the published study to the draft report that had something like 20 tables, much greater detail than was published, it was clear to me that the published paper was, in fact, falsified. They left out information that was in the draft that clearly showed that PFAS exposure was related to elevated cholesterol. And that means that the company and the company employed researchers were really providing misinformation that we can now see was quoted by CDC and EPA and other authorities also abroad. And I've seen numerous papers published since then, some of them by consulting companies, that is, scientists who are paid to do secondary research using whatever is available, and they oftentimes appear as defensive, meaning they are trying to elicit uncertainty and to highlight imprecision and bias so that they are essentially concluding that, oh, we don't know for sure, so it's too early to ban PFAS. I mean, this is what it says between the lines and the conclusions. And so we need to be very much aware of that, because I'm not saying that all academics are necessarily unbiased, but I think that when we see papers published with the support of the PFAS production or usage industry, that we have to be a little careful, because maybe it's like one of the companies in the late 1990s actually generated an internal document that said to the researchers, we are very much in favor of the work you do. We much appreciate it. But please remember that we need to publish everything as long as it's in accordance with the company policy and that it states that our products are safe to the environment and human health. And that's exactly what we have seen with, in fact, a good number of papers over the years. Let me just mention that the company that paid the $850 million to finish the legal case in Minnesota, after that compromise was reached and it was approved by the judge, the company released a statement that said that it is our firm belief that PFASs are not at all hazardous to the environment or to human health, but we agreed to pay this compensation to the state out of respect for society or something along those lines. And so they have continued claiming that PFASs are innocuous. And I don't know what to say, but in my mind, it goes against the scientific documentation.
We're seeing a huge spike in litigation around PFAS chemicals. The main source of litigation up to this point has been in drinking water supplies, identifying contamination of drinking water, identifying where that contamination comes from, whether it be from a manufacturing facility that was making PFAS, a military base that was using AFFF or aqueous film forming foam, which is a firefighting foam that's very effective at putting out fires, but historically was made with PFAS chemicals. It's a very useful chemical as a surfactant, as a fire-resistant chemical. It can spread and smother a fire very effectively. So it was used at military sites as well as civilian airports for quite a long time. We also see contamination arising from landfills where consumer products are disposed and ultimately those chemicals are released in the leachate that comes from those landfills. That's been one major category of PFAS litigation. We've also seen the rise of consumer products focused litigation, people filing suit because they've discovered PFAS chemicals or fluorine, which is sometimes used as essentially a screening tool for PFAS in a product. The allegations tend to focus on sustainability representations of those products. You've claimed that this product is organic or safe or healthy or good for the environment, and yet it contains these PFAS chemicals or fluorine, which we'll use as a screen to make allegations related to PFAS chemicals. Those are sort of the two categories of major lawsuits that we're seeing right now. But we're going to see the proliferation of these lawsuits in a number of different categories as the science really develops on this kind of thing.
Through these lawsuits and others that continue to this day, the human health and environmental impacts of PFAS chemicals have seen far more scientific research and conclusions that, yes, these are an extremely hazardous class of chemicals, and that even in low concentrations, they've been proven to pose health risks.
The more that scientists study PFAS, we learn that exposure to PFAS has been linked to a wide array of really serious health problems, including certain types of cancers, weaker immune system, increased cholesterol levels, pregnancy-induced hypertension, liver damage, reduced fertility. The risk goes on and on. And again, we know about this because many of the studies were done either on workers or in communities that were highly exposed to these chemicals. And it seems that almost every week a new scientific study is published that reveals the health risks that these chemicals can pose to our society. And certainly, some communities are more vulnerable than others, such as infants and young children whose bodies, their brains are still developing, which can make them more vulnerable to exposure. Pregnant women, we're particularly concerned about pregnant women's and women of childbearing age exposure to PFAS, given that exposure has been linked to certain reproductive health problems, including reduced birth weight. And of course, communities that are exposed to PFAS from contaminated drinking water and communities where PFAS are manufactured, such as places like Parkersburg, West Virginia, or North Carolina, communities that have been devastated from the production and the use of these chemicals that has not only exposed workers to potentially harmful levels of PFAS, but to the communities that live downstream of chemical manufacturing facilities like 3M and Chemours and DuPont.
As Mike Shade from Toxic Free Future stated, there are communities and groups of people at higher risk from exposure to PFAS chemicals, and young children are particularly at risk.
One of the things that was really alarming to us was a couple of years ago, we published a report looking at PFAS in women's breast milk. We collected samples of women's breast milk from 50 random women from the greater Seattle area. And what we wanted to understand was whether the legacy long-chain PFAS were present, but also whether or not the emerging short-chain PFAS were also appearing in women's breast milk. And shockingly, and to our surprise, we found not only the legacy PFAS, but we also saw the current use short-chain PFAS also showing up in women's breast milk. And that's a huge concern because we know that women can pass those chemicals on to their children who are particularly vulnerable to exposure to PFAS. And that's kind of what I was getting at before. The industry said, hey, you know, okay, we'll get away from the long-chain PFAS, but we don't need to worry about these short-chain PFAS. They're not persistent. They're not toxic. But guess what? They're building up in women's breast milk. And as a result, these chemicals are being passed on to infants and young children who are particularly vulnerable to exposure to these chemicals. And breast milk should be nature's purest food. There's no reason why some of the most persistent toxic chemicals on the planet are contaminating women's breast milk. I should say, though, that we're not encouraging women to stop breastfeeding. Despite that, breast milk is still an important source of nutrition for babies. But what a fundamental violation it is for what should be nature's purest food to be contaminated by industrial chemicals made by companies like DuPont, Chemours, and 3M. And if that's not a call to action, I don't know what is.
What I can say as a physician is that these chemicals can enter the body and that some of them can stay there for many, many years. We talk about half-lives, which represents the time it takes for the concentration in the body to be decreased by half. And for some of the PFASs, it may take something like 5 to 8 years before you can count on having decreased the burden by 50%. So that means that they are cumulative over time, accumulating more and more in your body if the exposure continues. And therefore, we're concerned about the long-term adverse health effects. There are two reasons for this. One group at particular risk is, of course, people who have elevated exposures, and that can be occupational, or it could be due to particular contamination, let's say, of your drinking water, or it could be because of particular sources of exposure. Let's say if you live near a polluting company, or let's say there is a waste deposit site near where you live, and circumstances like that. So that's one group of people at risk. The other group is the one that's particularly vulnerable. And we don't quite know exactly what specific diseases or whatever ailment that people might have that makes them more vulnerable. But we do know that in early life, we are highly vulnerable to PFASs because they will enter the fetal circulation during pregnancy. And they will also be excreted into human milk so that a young child can actually reach a blood concentration that of certain PFASs that can reach perhaps something like tenfold higher than what the mother has or rather had, because the mother benefits from eliminating these compounds from her own body. But the problem is she's sharing them with a much smaller organism, and therefore the child can develop very high concentrations of certain PFASs in the body.
It seems like the people most at risk are those who work in facilities handling PFAS directly. But in recent years, it has been discovered that nearly every living thing on this planet, both plants and animals, contains some level of PFAS. This is due to the ability PFAS has to migrate because it's extremely accumulative while being nearly impossible to remove.
In the manufacture of PFAS, very often there can be emissions out of smokestacks, that sort of thing, where there's liquid aerosols of the material going into the air or particles that it's attached to. they actually then come down with the rain. And when it rains, very often you can get the spreading from these aerosols being trapped and then falling to the Earth's surface with rain. Wastewater, very common, where the wastewater comes out the back of a plant and it goes into either a stream or maybe even it goes to a wastewater treatment plant, but then it goes through the wastewater treatment plant because it doesn't degrade. It doesn't biologically degrade. It goes out with the sludge and then is spread on farms. Probably the most, I would say, prevalent and obvious way that these compounds get into the environment is from a manufacturing facility that has had a tank that leaks, that had PFAS in it, has leaked down into the groundwater and migrated with groundwater to a surface water body or into a receptor like a lake or a groundwater extraction well that's used for drinking water. So manufacturing facilities that have had tanks of PFAS leak and or, as I mentioned before, fire training pits at airports and military bases where the pits were filled with diesel fuel and then sprayed with these foam, rain or infiltration into the soil, it gets into the groundwater. So let's talk a minute, if we could, about groundwater and what groundwater is. So groundwater isn't an underground river in most cases. It can be. Carlsbad Caverns, for example, has a small river running through it, and that's an underground stream that's where it's groundwater in the form of an actual river running in a space of ground. But more often than not, groundwater is simply rain that's migrated into the subsurface, and it's filling the pores in the soil or cracks in the rock. Imagine if you have a flower pot, for instance, and you start to pour water slowly into it, it'll disappear into the soil. If you keep pouring it, however, you'll see it rise up above the surface for a minute. That's the water table. And then it'll go back down into the flower pot. That's the water table surface in the groundwater within the flower pot. Okay, so if you didn't have a pot, you had instead just an open field and it rained like heck, you'd see the water come up above the ground and then the water table would move back down. That's the groundwater filling the pores. What happens is if you have an area that has more surface water entering the ground, it'll make a mound and that water will have to move downhill within the subsurface. So groundwater tends to move. And if it's moving under a facility that has a leaking tank, it'll carry a plume, P-L-U-M-E, of PFAS out from underneath the factory and out down gradient, maybe towards a residential area or maybe towards a stream. And if it intercepts that stream, that groundwater will, what we call daylight into the stream, and you'll see foam form. This, we've seen this in Michigan and some of the rivers that have been, streams that have been impacted by manufacturing facilities that have leaked PFAS. There's, if you go on the internet, you can actually see people throwing a fly in their waders with foam all around. So this is PFAS impacting surface water. Likewise, there are military bases where they've had firefighting foam leak from fire training areas down into that groundwater, and the groundwater has moved that plume of PFAS into the lakes. And people have shown up to their cottages in Michigan in the summer to open up their cottages and seen white foam sitting all around the docks. This is PFAS. So groundwater is probably, it's a main route of exposure to the public and natural resources to PFAS because of migration from source zones like military bases, airports, and manufacturing facilities that had leaks.
Unfortunately, I don't know if you know, there used to be a ride at Disneyland called It's a Small World. And it's definitely a small world for PFAS because they circle the globe. And indeed, a huge case of environmental injustice is some of the very highest levels are way up in the Arctic because chemicals like PFAS, there's a grasshopper effect where they go up in the air and they come down and they go up in the air and they come down until they reach the Arctic and they can't go any further. And so Arctic people actually, who don't use these products or have them much, but eat the local, you know, fish and greens, can have some of the highest levels in the world, which is super sad.
Some of the contamination we're worried about today actually started, you know, maybe 50 years ago. And it's, of course, much harder to remove the PFAS from the environment if this is like contamination of soil or this is a waste deposit site, because PFAS has over the years penetrated and moved downwards with rainwater, whatever it is, and perhaps reached the groundwater. And then from there, it has spread out, has reached various waterways like rivers or lakes. And so the contamination has moved, it has disseminated, and therefore created a much bigger problem. And I think that the consequences of this contamination is resulting in enormous expenses because the contamination is no longer local. It has been spread out. And I think it was in the 1990s that a company made a little pilot project and they got blood samples from albatrosses in the Pacific. And they found PFAS in the albatrosses, although the albatrosses had never used PFAS-treated rain gear or Teflon pads or whatever sources you might suspect for humans. The albatrosses were simply exposed to contamination that had disseminated into the Pacific. We're now dealing with a global problem.
You know, we think that prevention is the cure. And the best way to prevent PFAS from getting out into the environment is to phase out the use of it in areas where PFAS are most commonly used in products like food packaging, outdoor apparel, and other types of textiles, electronics, beauty and personal care products. PFAS are literally used in hundreds, if not thousands, of different types of consumer products. And that's why we need government agencies at all levels of government, from the local level to the state level, to the federal level, to the international level, to advance policies and laws to phase out and ban PFAS. And not only restrict PFAS, but to ensure that the substitutes are truly safe for people and the planet. We also need the business community to step up. We think that major retailers and brands have an important role to play. And over the last 10 to 20 years, we've seen some of the biggest corporations in the world adopt and begin to implement policies to phase out the use of PFAS in products or packaging that they sell. So we need action to not only clean up and mitigate our exposure to PFAS that are out there in the environment, but we need to cut it off at the tap. We need to cut it off at the source.
In the next episode of Forever Chemicals, we take a good hard look at how PFAS has been used in the outdoor industry as a performance chemistry and question how truly necessary it was to add in the first place. If you want to learn more about what PFAS are, where they're found, the proven health effects, how you can limit your exposure, up-to-date news on PFAS, and how to get involved in PFAS regulatory efforts, visit toxicfreefuture.org, foodandwaterwatch.org, or PFASCentral.org. SnapLink Consulting provided expert fact-checking and guidance for the creation of this podcast. SnapLink Consulting provides corporate sustainability strategies and ESG support across a broad range of industries, including apparel, footwear, home furnishings, software, cosmetics, professional services, and more. Head to snaplinkconsulting.com to learn more and contact the experts to guide you through complex topics like CSRD, PFAS, greenhouse gas assessments, SBTI, CDP, EcoVadis, B Corp, and many more compliance and certification frameworks. Forever Chemicals is a Black-Footed Ferret production. All the source material for this episode can be found in the show notes or at theoutdoorminimalist.com/forever chemicals. As an independent podcast, we rely on listener support as our primary avenue for funding. If you like this show and our other content, consider donating to our GoFundMe. The link is in the show notes.